right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah, I just can't stop when I hear that music. And I'm going to rush, okay? Because we got a packed show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with the director, writer, and two actors from a great new play I saw last week called The Princes of King's Road. And we'll talk more about that when we get to that point, but it's really a remarkable piece of work, all right? We're also going to hear from Juanita Young, who's the mother of Malcolm Ferguson, who was executed by the New York City police a number of years back. And she's part of Rise Up October, and we'll be hearing a statement from her calling on people or telling people about what Rise Up October is about, all right? Opening the show up, though, I'm really pleased to bring you a segment I did with Raymond Latta, and I recorded this a little while back. He's a political economist and writer for Revolution Newspaper, RevCom.us, and he's an advocate of the new synthesis of communism developed by Bob Avakian. And he's talking with us today on the Pope's statement on climate change. So without another word, let's check out what Raymond has to say about that. A short while ago, Pope Francis, the leader of the Catholic Church, issued a major document on climate change. The Pope expressed deep concern over the state of the world and the pressing need to deal with climate change and global warming. Many, including many on the left and in the movement to fight the destruction of the planet, see this Pope's encyclical as a possible game changer in the effort to stop the assault on the global environment. My guest, Raymond Latta, political economist, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and an advocate for the new synthesis of communism developed by Bob Avakian, strongly disagrees. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on again, and this is a very important issue for us to be talking about.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to jump into this right away, man. So what do you got against the Pope, man, huh?
Well, look, I think we can't be looking at things from the standpoint of a hope and a prayer, if I can be a bit ironic here. What we really have to do is examine what this document represents and what, in fact, is needed if we are going to save this planet from destruction and devastation. And that is the trajectory that we are on now. So let's just step back and look at what's happened. The Pope issued this encyclical, this major document on climate change in June. And in it, he says some things that have not been said by the Catholic Church before. He indicts the desecration and the destruction and the disregard for the environment. He acknowledges that climate change, you know, is a phenomenon and that human activity has something to do with it. And he calls for some kind of action, some kind of change in government policy so that measures can be taken to arrest this crisis. Now, that has been received in various progressive and environmental quarters as a very, very positive development, that one, the Vatican is now opening the church up to a scientific dialogue that didn't exist before, two, that he's using his voice and authority to affect some kind of positive change. And this could actually influence things in a direction that would fundamentally sort of alter the course that we're on. And my answer to that is wrong, wrong, wrong. And this is the substance of my article. And I think what I do here is dig into why that is the case. And the first point that I make is, you know, we really have to look at the larger context in which the Pope has released this document. And I can get into that now if we want to pursue it.
Yeah, I'd like to, because, you know, that's actually sort of what I was going to lead into anyway, because the Pope does actually, you know, he does actually speak out around a lot of the stuff that you're talking about in terms of, you know, and people looking at it and saying, well, this makes a difference. Like I said, people, a lot of people are saying, actually, this makes a big difference. And I wanted you to talk about the fact that the Pope does, in a lot of ways, he speaks to and criticizes capitalism sort of from a side angle, but he said, you know, and he talks about how it's savaged much of the planet. But you say that doesn't go far enough.
Well, it's not that it doesn't simply go far enough. This is why I want to sort of get at the context. What's the backdrop for the Pope issuing this document? The core teachings of the church have not changed. The ideological, the enslaving ideological role that the church plays in human society, chaining people to the status quo, to patriarchy, to the systems of exploitation that the church has happily coexisted with, that has not changed. The church's role in society, maintaining people in a subordinate, dominated, subjugated state. What has changed is nature. We're witnessing this unprecedented ecological crisis, and human society has changed and evolved. And the church is responding to both of those facts and is trying to maintain its legitimacy and playing a certain role in keeping people's faith in the system intact. And that's the irony here, because it seems as though the church and the Pope in particular here is criticizing capitalism. But what he's really responding to, is both this accelerating environmental crisis and the fact that there has been, over the last decade, a growing groundswell of resistance, widespread dissatisfaction with the inaction and the complacency of the governments and the institutions, the dominant ruling institutions of the world, and then in the oppressed nations of the third world, where the church has its greatest numbers of adherents, this is where climate change is taking its greatest toll, and this is where this environmental crisis, you know, in the years to come, will exact an even more horrific toll. And at the same time, you have the workings of the imperialist world economy, which is not simply at the font of and accelerating this environmental crisis, but is also leading to unprecedented gaps and chasms between the rich and the poor, the inequalities that people are very much aware of. And in the third world, this is very intensely expressed. The environmental crisis in terms of extreme weather conditions, the melting of the polar ice caps, rising sea levels that threaten entire cities in the third world and coastal cities in the advanced capitalist countries as well. This crisis, as it is developing, is causing great concern in ruling circles. And they are concerned not so much about what this means for humanity or what it means for the ecosystems of the planet, but what it means for the stability, the political and social stability of their system and its profitable functioning. So this is what they are responding to, and the Pope is responding to this in similar measure. Michael and your listeners who may have encountered this document and read parts of it, what I do in my article in RevCom that's entitled Straight Talk on the Pope and Climate Change, I pull to the surface a statement in it that's buried, but very, very indicative of what the Pope is actually responding to. And what he says in the document, this 182-page document, is, and I'm going to quote, he says, "So our concern cannot be limited merely to the threat of extreme weather events, but must also extend to the catastrophic consequences of social unrest," unquote. That is a passage in this document. The point I'm making is that the Pope, in a similar vein to the ruling powers of the world, is worried about the ways in which this climate crisis is going to impact social stability. So he is issuing this document as a way of drawing people back in to the system, because there's growing disaffection and alienation from the system that is driving the environmental crisis, and trying to shore up people's faith in this system. And what he's doing is making some very well-crafted, modulated criticisms, not of capitalism, but of the effects of capitalism, the excesses of capitalism, as a way of telling people that, A, I'm concerned, and B, we can work within the framework of this system to solve this problem, which in fact is not the case, that only the most radical restructuring of society and economy can bring about the kind of change that is necessary to confront this environmental crisis, not just climate change, but the entire environmental emergency that humanity faces that puts ecosystems and human civilization and the planet itself in peril. The Pope is issuing this statement to tell people we must be concerned, but we must work within the framework of this system. And we have the capability to do that if we exert moral influence and combine spirituality with an appeal to the powers that be to change their ways. And this is actually an obstacle to what people need to understand about the workings of this system, the capitalist imperialist system, that is at the bottom of this crisis, that has driven this crisis, and what people need to do now, which is not to kind of attach themselves to the politicians and to the system and hope for the best and pray for the best and exert moral sway, but rather to actually engage in the most determined struggle to save the planet. And ultimately, as I point out in my article, only the overturning of this entire capitalist imperialist system and its replacement by a whole new economic, social, political system can address this problem on the scale and with the urgency required.
Now, we're going to get into a bunch of that as we go along. But first, I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show. And we're talking today with Raymond Latta, political economist, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and advocate for the new synthesis of communism developed by Bob Avakian. And we're talking about an article Raymond recently did on the Pope's encyclical on global warming, on the assault on the environment. Now, Raymond, here's the thing. I want to get into a couple of points here that you've raised. And in terms of what you've labeled the sort of a calculated expression, he criticizes some of the effects of capitalism, a calculated criticism of capitalism. There is a point where he talks about, and I think this is important for people to understand, and you've talked about this in your article, and it was really enlightening to me, where he talks about the root cause. When he criticizes capitalism, he's actually talking about the root cause of the problems with the climate, of the assault on the planet, is the dominance of a technocratic paradigm driven by power. And I think that is related to his other point about the key change required is one of culture and morality. But I wanted to first talk about, what does he mean? What do you see by this? And what's the problem with this pointing out that the root cause is the dominance of a technocratic paradigm driven by power?
Yeah, what he means by that is that contemporary society is too reliant on science and technology to understand what is going on around us and for solutions. And within that paradigm that he calls the technocratic paradigm is what he feels and what he argues is a drive towards mastery and command over nature. And that is what he is saying is causing the problems that we're witnessing on a global scale. And he combines that with a critique of consumerist values and people being sort of lured by material goods. And he actually calls for a new kind of asceticism, renunciation of material wealth, and people being content with their material lot, but reinventing themselves culturally and spiritually. And what I do in my article and what's important for us to be thinking about is what is actually causing this environmental crisis. Is it technology in and of itself? Is it science? I mean, actually, science and technology in the proper social system, in a system that puts the needs of humanity and the protection of the planet and the emancipation of humanity above everything else, in that kind of social, institutional, economic framework, which is socialism and communism, then technology and science can be unleashed to solve the problems of society and to actually address this climate crisis. So what he's saying is that science and technology in and of themselves are the problem. And this, of course, goes along well with the church's, you know, anti-scientific, anti-rationalist viewpoint and worldview. And he's saying, again, that people have to sort of change their thinking and their values, when in fact we have a system, an economic political system, capitalism, imperialism, which is founded on exploitation. The Pope doesn't say that the problem with technology and science is that in the hands of the capitalist imperialist system, it's led to wars, to horrific exploitation, to the plunder of the planet, what these oil companies, the fossil fuel industry, what capitalism is doing to the planet, where it transforms nature into an input, into a source of wealth and profit. He's saying, well, it's technology and science that somehow have gotten out of hand. And we really have to understand that science and technology and management and the ways in which the economy function and are governed all reflect the drive for profit, the competitive urgings of capital. And this is resulting in what has happened to the planet. And I go very carefully in this article to explain how it is that capitalism is actually driving this crisis. And what the Pope is doing is talking about some of the excesses, the inequities. And this is a way, as I said, both of getting people back into the framework of thinking that the problem is not the system, but the excesses of the system, and to peel away from the kind of determined massive resistance that's called for.
You know, one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit more, too, is that this thing about the, and this is something that gets pushed out a lot by the people who are actually advocating for the, I don't know how great it is that the Pope came out with this document and the rest is, the idea that the key thing is changing the culture and a new morality. And I think that you've done a lot in your work. You've done a lot of work analyzing why things are the way they are in the world in terms of what leads capitalism to do the things that it does. It isn't a matter of intent, but a matter of necessity. And I thought that was extremely important in terms of understanding what's wrong with the Pope's call for just a new culture of morality. There does need to be a new culture of morality aside from what the hellish thing that we have that is running the world right now. But that's not the solution to this. And I think you've done a lot of work actually pinpointing that.
Yeah, you know, Michael, any society, we live in a capitalist imperialist society, any society is a system that operates according to certain rules and certain dynamics. And at the base of every society is the economy, because without economic activity, people can't survive. They can't have food, shelter, clothing, and in short order, people would die off if there were no economic organization of society. And that is at the base of human society. And in capitalist imperialist society, there are certain rules of the game, if you will, certain ways in which the system functions. And the driving force of this system is profit and the competitive drive for profit and more profit. This is why you see capitalist investors turning rainforest into agribusiness enterprise. This is why fossil fuels are so central to the functioning of the capitalist economy, because they're highly profitable. There's so much capital that's invested within them. And the system is driven by profit, driven by the drive for profit and more profit. You know, I commented in this article and in others, if General Motors, for instance, were to say, well, look, we're not going to grow as fast as we grow. We're not going to expand for profit and more profit. We're going to move out of the China market because we want to save China and the rest of the planet for more carbon emissions. Well, if General Motors were to reach that conclusion, you could say goodbye, General Motors, because Volkswagen, Toyota, they're going to beat them out. This is the way the system functions, that it's profit and not just a certain amount of profit. They have to keep driving and accumulating for more profit because it's competition. If they don't beat out their competitors, then they are going to be beat out and will no longer be functioning capitalists. And that's why we see this drive to exploit oil resources in the Arctic. That's why we see these oil companies going toward West Africa. Environmental President Barack Obama has overseen the largest increase in oil production in the U.S.'s recent history. And we've seen the opening up the eastern seaboard, the mid-Atlantic, to offshore drilling. And now they're giving Shell permits to go into the Arctic. So there's this drive for profit. There's this incredible, on a world scale, rivalry between the great powers for control over resources, control over different regions of the world. And that's why, you know, we're seeing these moves by the U.S. and other countries into the Arctic to control those resources. And oil is a strategic commodity. It's a source of strength in the competitive battle. It's control over oil gives you control over the workings of the world economy. And the other thing about capitalism, I've indicated two key features of it, the drive for profit and more profit that's goaded on by competition. There's rivalry, the great power rivalry between powers, the capitalist and imperialist powers for control of markets, resources, and beating each other out. And this is playing out on a world scale now around energy resources. And the other thing about capitalism, and I want the listeners to think about this, is that when you have a system that's based on private ownership, driven by profit, and you have incredible scale of investment over resources, raw materials, technology, you have a situation where these individual capitals who are striving to maximize their profits and reduce costs, because it's privately owned and controlled and serving the private accumulation of profit, their vision, their framework, their field of concern is their unit, their sphere of ownership. So that when a steel company, for instance, produces steel and pollutes the air, well, they're concerned about minimizing costs within that enterprise. But what they do to the air, the pollution, that's not a cost for them. That's what in economic theory is called an externality, an external effect of what they do. But that doesn't enter into their calculations. So you have a system of private ownership driven by profit, driven by this urging to expand or you lose out and die. And its calculus is that sphere of ownership. So what any individual capital does outside, what the effects are environmentally to neighboring communities, to what has happened in parts of the third world where they go in and invest to extract raw materials, but then they pollute rivers, then they destroy habitat. But that's not a monetary concern to them. So this is the nature of the beast, if you will. We step back and look at what the Pope is saying, set against that actual understanding of what's driving this environmental crisis, and we see that not only is what he's saying wrong and not really getting at the heart and to the root of this, but it's actually something that leads people away from what we need to confront and what we need to act on.
First, I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Raymond Latta, political economist, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and advocate for the new synthesis of communism developed by Bob Avakian. And we're talking about an article Raymond recently did on the Pope's encyclical on global warming, on the assault on the environment. Now, I have two more questions, and one is, I'll just say right now, it's based on everything you've been saying. Really, it's incredible. I mean, you make a very compelling argument. And the thing is that I've been reading a lot of things, a lot of people's commentaries on the Pope's encyclical, including yesterday, I think I was telling you earlier, I was reading Bill McKibben's piece in the New York Review of Books. And one of the things that all these people seem to be arguing is that no matter what its shortcomings, no matter what you personally think about this, that it's overall better for the planet and for humanity to have somebody who's at the top of those considered to be global leaders in terms of morality and reason and whatnot, stepping out to argue against the destruction of the planet. It can only do good things in terms of the creating the kind of climate we need to actually be able to pursue the changes that are needed. What do you say to that?
Well, what I say is, again, that this is profoundly wrong, because there's an argument that, look, this crisis is so dire that any statement from any world leader is better than nothing if it's pointing to the crisis that exists. But what I'm arguing, what I'm showing, and what in fact is the reality, this was the point of the Obama example that I gave, where he talks a good talk about climate change and as against the climate change deniers, right, who are consciously burying science. You know, Obama seems enlightened. How could this not but help? But look at what Obama has done. This is what I said, that he's increased oil production. He's opened up new spheres to oil drilling. And you have Hillary Clinton, who's also talking about climate change and who won't even say that the Keystone XL pipeline is a disaster if it's enacted. She won't say anything about it because the State Department is deliberating on whether or not and how that will serve the strategic interest of imperialism. The Pope is making his statements about the environment. And the point that has to be understood is that the longer this system stays in power, in effect, then the exponentially faster does this environmental crisis unfold. And what's required is to get rid of this system through revolution, through a movement for revolution that is being built today with the Revolutionary Communist Party at its core, uniting broadly with people throughout society who are concerned about the state and fate of the planet, who are involved in different kinds of active resistance to this. But this needs to be taken to a whole new level. And the point about the Pope, and as I said, we need a revolution, a whole new restructuring of society in which you have an economic planning that takes place, not on the basis of profit maximization, but on advancing the cause of emancipating humanity, meeting the basic needs and overcoming the great inequalities of human society and the planet, and protecting the ecosystems of the planet. We need a whole new system to actually confront this crisis. And what the Pope is doing is lassoing people back into pressure group politics that's serving a bigger agenda, which is to keep people chained to this system. So this is, people need to understand the scope and the scale of this crisis. And many of the best environmental thinkers and activists and leaders are not acting on the best research that they've done, which shows just how precipitous the state of affairs is. And we need to bring to people an understanding. And that's what I'm doing in this article. That's what RevCom and the Revolutionary Communist Party is doing. Bring people an understanding of what is actually driving this crisis and what it's going to take to actually address it, tackle it, create a sustainable society and economy, protect the environment of this planet, repair what can be repaired. And a lot of this is irreversible. This is just a fact. And to be able to make the adaptations in the functioning of human society that can both address this crisis and serve the interest of humanity. What the Pope is doing is making some bland, and I have to say, some bland statements about the environmental crisis and telling people that they have to change their moral and spiritual ways, when the problem, in fact, is not that capitalism has gone a little too far in destroying the planet, but that capitalism is destroying the planet. And we need a new society, a new economy, and new values that can take hold that will actually enable us to confront and act on this crisis.
All right, Raymond, one more question. You know, you've been talking throughout the course of this interview about how revolution is the solution, is the thing that can open up a gateway, a pathway to actually reversing all this and actually saving the planet and human existence and other existence as well. I wanted to ask you, though, like, could you give people a concrete idea of just how this would be done? What would it look like in this new socialist society you're talking about getting to through revolution?
Yeah, Michael, let's first be clear, as we've been emphasizing throughout the course of this interview, that we are dealing with a monumental, unprecedented environmental emergency. And how much of the planet's ecosystems can be saved from the destruction that has already taken place, and the destruction that is in fact locked in because of the incredible use of fossil fuels, we don't know. But only by restructuring society radically, by forging a new socialist economy that's based on different principles, can we in any way address this crisis on the scale and with the urgency, and to be able to devote the resources and mobilize the know-how and the capability and creativity of people to create a society that is sustainable, to restore what can be restored and repair what can be repaired and to save what can be saved of the ecosystems, and then to adapt in ways, that is, in human society and in how we live, in ways that do serve the betterment of world humanity. Now, in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America, draft proposal from the Revolutionary Communist Party, and in another important document that people can find at revcom.us entitled Some Key Principles of Socialist Sustainable Development, the Revolutionary Communist Party does lay out and set forth in a very comprehensive and visionary way how a socialist sustainable society would function, what it would look like. And here I can briefly get into some of the key elements of that.
Okay, go ahead and do that, man.
Yeah, sure. Well, the first point is that the orientation of the new socialist society is thoroughly internationalist. One of the first acts of the socialist revolution when it comes to power in what is today the United States will be to immediately dismantle all the military bases that were at the core of the U.S. empire, and also put an end to all the global grids and networks of cheap labor, pollution-intensive, polluting, environmentally destructive production. And the new socialist society that will be established and created will have as its orientation both meeting the needs of the people, advancing the cause of revolution, urgently working for the emancipation of world humanity, is the primary criterion of the new socialist society, and working to protect the ecosystems of the planet. And on the level of an economy, the new socialist economy would put the protection of the ecology, the planet, above its own national development. And now we live in a capitalist imperialist system that's destroying the resources of the planet, that ravaging materials and using fossil fuels to serve the private profit of small groups of capitalist imperialists who then are fighting it out with each other for global domination. And then we have a phenomenon now where sea levels are rising in various parts of the world. You're seeing huge threats to the well-being of huge concentrations of humanity. And we're going to be faced with a situation, and I think the audience perhaps has read about this, we're going to be faced with a situation where large numbers of people, humanity, are going to be leaving and having to depart different coastal regions. And we live in a world now, if you look at what's happening in the Mediterranean, where people are dying in the Mediterranean who are seeking shelter. We have to create a world where we can welcome people who are fleeing both horrific conditions of social existence, but also this environmental crisis. And that is built into the orientation of the New Socialist Republic, the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic that I'm talking about. So, one, the internationalist orientation is very crucial, and that means putting the interests of humanity and the protection of the planet's ecosystems above its own development. Two, we are talking about a system of economic planning, of rational, long-term, socialist economic planning that's based on the largest and most important needs of human society and the protection of the planet. We would be working right away to restructure the economy away from fossil fuels and to be developing and promoting renewable sources of energy, solar, geothermal, wind. We would be mobilizing the knowledge of people. We would be linking the expert knowledge of scientists and engineers with the basic understanding of people who are living close to the ground in different parts of the world. Indigenous peoples, people that are living in the forest, people that are involved in fishing. We'd be combining and learning those knowledges, and we'd be working together. The Constitution for the New Socialist Republic and the key principles, what's called some key principles of socialist sustainable development, calls for unprecedented cooperation on a global scale to share knowledge, to share insights, to learn in this way that I'm talking about, and also recognizes that there's a responsibility of the former imperialist country of what is today the United States, where we have a revolution that brings into being a whole new economic and social system, a new political power that's defeated and dismantled the old state power, that now that new society has a responsibility to address the legacy of the carbon emissions that have been put into the atmosphere by the capitalist imperialist system. So it has to take the globe, the whole planet, into account in its economic planning and in its allocation of resources. This would be a society that would be creating a new kind of socialist city that's not built on waste and wasteful consumption, that's able to produce more of its needs agriculturally, that would not rely on global networks of transport. That would be all part of creating a new revolutionary society in which you're breaking down boundaries between people, overcoming divisions between nationalities, in which you're addressing the oppression of women, and creating a society where people can join together to confront both the inequalities that have been inherited from the old society and to deal on every level, at the local, the regional, national, and international level, this crisis. And another important element of the new socialist society would be to instill in people, not just promoting a scientific understanding of the world and the scientific method, but also to instill in people new values, a recognition that we have a responsibility to protect the planet for current and for future generations. And there's a lot of righteous and rightful in praise of anti-consumerism among large sections of the environmental movement and progressive-minded people. But right now in this society, the understanding that we can't just live in a way that is a throwaway society of consume more and throw it away and replace one model with the newer model of a computer or car or what have you. We have to create a whole new mindset, not just a new transportation system that's not based and centered on a fossil fuel absorbing commodity that is the automobile, but we have to develop a whole new mode of safe and renewably based transit. But we also have to forge these new values where people are no longer judging the merit and value of life on the basis of how much one consumes, how many toys one has at the end of the day. And in a new socialist society, that's not just something that is at best in this society a moral exhortation, but something that can actually take effect, Michael, because we no longer have an economy that's ruled by profit, that's no longer governed by the imperative to sell, to sell, to sell, to sell more and to buy more. So these are the kinds of things that we can be achieving in a new socialist economy and world. And as I said, we are engaged in a battle. It's a global battle to save the planet from ecological catastrophe. We can't say in advance whether we can win that. And we don't know what level of dislocation and suffering is going to be induced just by what has, as I said, been locked into place by this crisis. But this is the only chance that we have. This kind of restructuring of society and economy on a socialist basis and on a society that's moving forward to emancipate all of humanity and to put an end to the very division of society, global society, into classes. This is the only way that we can actually confront this crisis and work to, as I said, reverse the damage that can be reversed, but also to adapt in ways that are both sustainable in terms of the future of the planet and that are consistent with the needs of emancipating world humanity.
All right, Raymond, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for having me on, and I look forward to future discussions about this and other topics.
Definitely. All right. Thanks a lot, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Raymond Lotta, political economist, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and an advocate of the new synthesis of communism developed by Bob Avakian. And Raymond has been setting the record straight. The Pope's encyclical is not something to celebrate, but something to recognize as very dangerous in the world today. Well, before we move along to the rest of the show, I wanted to play a little piece for you from Bob Avakian. And this is taken from his speech, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About, which you can access on the internet by going to revolutiontalk.net. And this particular piece is called Not Fit Caretakers for the Planet.
Let's look a little more fully at the history of this system. Its crimes all over the world, as well as within the U.S. itself. Look at what their system is doing to the earth, how it is wrecking the environment. In places like Brazil, as well as in places in Africa and Asia, there are beautiful rainforests full of a rich diversity of species which are being torn down and destroyed by the ever-hungry engine of this system. These are not just short-term effects. This has a long-term effect on the environment, not just in those places, but all over the world. And it has an effect on the people, too. For example, in Brazil, indigenous people whose way of life was based on living in the rainforest wake up one day to see a bulldozer knocking down the trees 100 yards from where they've always lived. And what's the result of this? Many of them can no longer go on living the way they were before. And one of the things that happens is many of the young women go into the cities in Brazil to become prostitutes because that's the only way they can survive. And now we have people like Bush and them talking about drilling for oil in Alaska. Once again, hungry for oil without regard to the environment or the effects on the people for generations to come. At the same time, they're breaking or refusing to sign agreements on the environment, on global warming, backing out of these agreements if they made them in the first place. Once again, these are not just so-called isolated incidents they always tell us about. The few rotten apples. This is what they have done and are doing to the environment throughout the U.S. and all over the world.
All right, once again, that was Bob Avakian, and it was an excerpt from a piece he did on climate during a talk given a number of years ago, and the talk was called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About, and the piece is Not Fit Caretakers for the Planet. All right, and what we're going to be talking about now for a quick few minutes, all right, everybody knows, or they should know, or I hope they know, or they're going to know, that October 24th, Rise Up October, 22nd, 23rd, and especially the 24th in New York City, where many thousands of people are expected to fill the streets all right, to fill the streets and to take a stand clearly stating which side they are on. And what they're talking about is, if you think about it, the just horrible, the rampant police murder of black and brown people, a slow genocide that is turning into a quick genocide. And it's a, and we're going to be bringing you over the next couple of weeks, as I've said before, voices of the people involved in this. And today we're bringing you Juanita Young, the voice of Juanita Young, an outspoken activist against police brutality and oppression. She's the mother of Malcolm Ferguson, murdered by New York City cops on March 1st, 2000.
We have here on stage with us family members who have all lost someone to police murder. I'd like to invite each of them up individually to speak, to tell you about their experience and why Rise Up October is so important to them. The first parent I'd like to invite up is Miss Juanita Young, the mother of Malcolm Ferguson. No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Justice.
What do we want?
Justice!
Thank you. But that's not loud enough, because I'm still trying to get Rivera for the murder of my son. On March 1st of 2000, my son Malcolm Ferguson was murdered in the Bronx by police officer Louis Rivera. He literally blew my son's brains out. After the DA, Robert Johnson, refused to indict this cop, I took the case to civil court. In civil court, my attorney, Seth Harris, was able to get Louis Rivera to admit what really happened. According to Rivera, he murdered Malcolm for no reason. When you ask, why did you shoot him, he don't know. But why is this man still out on the street today? That's why I have to keep asking for justice, because there is no way this man is still able to walk and be a police officer, and I have to live and cry every day because I can't touch, see, or hear my son. My family is destroyed by the loss of their brother. After 15 years of helping so many other families to deal with the pain of losing a loved one, watching this system allow these low-lifed police officers, because you can't tell me there's no good cop, bad cop, because when you stand by and allow that other cop to do harm to another person, you're just as guilty as that cop that put that bullet in his head. I don't go for a good cop, bad cop. I stand up here today and tell you, I'm going to stand for these 275 faces that's been murdered here in New York alone. That's why we need to rise up for October. We need to let the people know we had enough. We had enough of y'all coming in to our community, destroying families. We had enough of nobody paying attention. These politicians, these presidents don't give a damn, excuse my language, about us. Because why? That's why these 275 cases, not one of them got any justice. Why? Because of the people that's protecting them. All of us sitting here today need to grab another 500 people and let's flood New York on October 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. Thank you.
All right, welcome back. That was Juanita Young talking about Rise Up October. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with the director, writer, and the two actors from The Princes of Kings Road. This is a great play. You're going to want to stay tuned for this, because it just knocked my socks off when I saw it. So stay tuned.
Blue lights, big crowd, jukebox, plays loud. No tears, no cares. Everybody rocking everywhere I come.
All right, I had to do that, all right? It's Roy Orbison with Rock House, all right? And I just thought it captures the spirit of what we're talking about. Plus, it had the word house. And we're going to be talking with some actors and the writer-director of a play that's all about architects, all right? And they did so much more than design houses, but they certainly designed some of the most amazing and revolutionary architecture buildings. You look at their work, and it was just astounding, and it sort of changed the whole world of architecture. All right, and joining us right now is the playwright, Tom Lazarus. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And the two actors, John Nielsen. John,
thank you.
Welcome. And Ray Sifo.
Yes, thank you, Michael.
Okay. Now, you cool with CIFO?
CIFO is great.
Okay, all right. All right, so anyway, and by the way, John plays Schindler, right? And you play Neutra, okay?
Yes.
And you play the guy who's behind the scenes saying, get it right, get it right.
They got it right.
Yeah, they did. They certainly did. Well, Tom, give us a sense of what led you to this. And, you know, and I can tell people, I'll just read this real quick so we don't have to go through all this. But The Princes of Kings Road is a true story about the iconic L.A.-based architects Richard Neutra and Rudolf Schindler, once friends and business partners, but who became bitterly estranged for 23 years. They found themselves occupying the same hospital room in Cedars of Lebanon Hospital. What led you to the story that came after that?
It was the possibilities of what happened in that room. All we really know of this unbelievably chance meeting after 23 years was that the door closed, they spoke German, they were both born in Vienna, and they laughed a lot. And that guided me. I love their architecture. It's iconic. It's incredibly modern even today. But the dramatic possibilities of them going and being able to deal with the things that broke them up so bitterly 23 years ago, and for them to have this chance to air it, to get revenge, to accuse each other, to defend themselves, those dramatic possibilities is why I wrote the play.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you said they laughed a lot, I was hoping you were going to say that, because, you know, when you look at it, and there's so much, actually, there is so much humor in everything you've written in this play. And at the same time, if that humor is like riding the back of some real, particularly on Schindler's piece, huh, John? You've got to explain that one, my friend. But especially riding on the back of that is a lot of bitterness, a lot of things that happened over the years. And to hear you say that even in reality that they laughed a lot, because you were talking about what was heard in that room was that they laughed a lot, and then you came to it and you developed something which you said had to appeal to people's hearts. And I wanted to talk about that a little.
I've spent a lot of years in movies and television, and we kill a lot of people in movies and television. A lot of people carry guns. My hope in this play was to engage people emotionally, psychologically, aesthetically, architecturally, if there's such a word. And that was my goal. And having the ability to work with these kind of wonderful actors who delve into these characters more deeply than you have a chance in a lot of other venues was a gift. And to be able to put it on in a Richard Neutra space with Dione Neutra music, who's Richard Neutra's wife, playing the cello, it's a Neutra Schindler fest.
Yeah, and it was incredible actually to find out about that, and then to hear that cello in the background. It was just amazing. It was really incredible. Let me go to you guys. Actually, I think we'll start with you first, Ray. But there's a whole point here of you guys. If you think about what you were put into, the scene that you were put into, you guys had to really develop some kind of understanding of the complexity, as well as the sort of the bitterness and everything else, but the complexity of your characters. Let's talk about that. I think you even mentioned in an interview one time, you had to really try and understand your character.
It's a great story. This is a real gift for me as an actor to get a chance to put myself into the soul of this particular person. I'm on in years right now. I'm 73.
What?
There's a great sense of loss, opportunities lost, the things that cannot be recouped. They're gone. And the resonance of that is really universal. And I think it's very, very touching and moving in the play. And there's so many things that we never had a chance to talk out because of the bitterness and estrangement. And here's this gift, you know, after 23 years. It doesn't feel like a gift at the opening because it's so frightening and disturbing. But I don't want to overstate that, but
well, there is a point, though. There is a point that you actually said you came to love your character, which is kind of interesting. I mean, I guess everybody, when you're playing somebody, you do come to at least deeply understand somebody. Even if you're playing somebody who's a scoundrel, you have to come to really deeply understand. But to say that you loved your character as he developed was kind of interesting, too.
Yeah, I mean, any actor playing any role, no matter who he is, villain or hero, you have to be able to identify and own that person. In this case, I mean, this man is not a villain. He has his faults. And to own up to the losses, even as I defend myself in the play, there's an undercurrent of, did I make a mistake? Had I made a mistake? Did I really estrange my partner? Could I have done more? I'm not going to admit to that in the play because then I can't play the character the way I want to play him.
Okay.
But of course the answer is yes.
Which brings us right to your character, John. So go ahead, man.
Well, I mean, what Ray is saying is right. I mean, you have to be able to identify, and I would go even one step further and agree with what you're saying, or what he had said earlier, which is that you have to love your characters. And I think even if you are playing an absolute villain scoundrel, I think the only way to make a three-dimensional character is to try to understand what brings somebody to a certain point, whether it's in a B-movie or a wonderful play. I think it's very, very important. And when you do that, if that's who you are as an artist, then you have to embrace that person and love them. In regards to Neutra, yeah, I think Neutra certainly had an agenda. But I think for my part as an actor in a wonderful play is also trying to understand my own downfall. Was it just because of my partner's agenda, or was it, am I partly responsible? And when you have a history that Schindler does as a womanizer, you have to figure that at some point, you know, the two things put them together. And yeah, it's word gets around a very small town at the time. People aren't going to hire you if they know you're going to be bedding down their wives. Combined with Neutra, maybe the possibility that he was just, you know, abandoning ship and saving himself.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Tom Lazarus, the playwright and director of The Princes of King's Road. And Tom, we'll take us back to you. You talked about your plays. You said your plays, you never stop working on them, and they continue to evolve. And I was wondering about the process, what these guys are discovering about their characters. Whether you had written that in there or not, they're discovering things about the characters. But that must contribute to how the play evolves in your mind.
Well, as a playwright, when I engage actors and the stage manager and tech director, everyone gets involved, and it's a truly collaborative. And I learn about the play. I learn about the characters from the actors. They learn about the play from me, and it all goes into a synthesis of ideas. And we wrote after every rehearsal. You know, I would deliver new pages, and it would get better, and it would get better, and it's... Well, I was just talking with a producer this morning of, gee, I'd like to take another crack at those pages. You know, there's still some things that, you know, and that's the wondrous gift that we have about doing theater.
Let me go back to you guys again. You know, I want to talk, and then, Tom, you are going to have to chime in on this at some point, all right, because it was in your head, okay? Mm-mm. But it's also real. The thing that comes out with both of you guys and with your characters, Max, Ray Max, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about here.
Okay.
Ray, one of the things that comes out in your character is, yes, you know, you're very likable, but there is this sort of thing of even when you're wrestling with in your own mind, did you screw your partner? You know, was there something? Did you, you know, something, there was obviously something real that happened there. And John, you are very bitter, obviously, and you can hit me if you want to, but you're sitting too far away. But your character is really bitter about this. And yet the two of you have this relationship that just, it's really interesting because it comes through. In this, the softness between the two of you, that in times that are, you know, when the other person can't see it, the concern about the condition of each other. But even more than that, there's something that happened.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I wrote that based on a personal experience. I had very, very close friends, very, very close friends. And for unexplained reasons, we stopped seeing each other for 30 years and recently came back together. And the intimacy was still there. After 30 years, it was like just getting back on the train. We could pick it right up exactly where we were. And that's what informed the character, these characters. They lived in the same house. They were partners. They had a salon of the intelligentsia of the time. And then it was gone. And this, I understand the intimacy that they have as two characters and their ability. And now they have the venue to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And that's where it comes from.
Now, real quick, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you guys about was this idea of, and you both say it, like you're saying, you say when you're towards the end of the play and you're talking about, well, you know, each one of your separate career. And I think you said, but you were so visionary and artistic. And you say, you were so. And then Ray answers you saying, practical, functional. But there's something there that comes out in terms of when you really want to create something that's going to shake the world and bust open whole new doors, that unity between the being visionary and just letting it fly and the need to be practical in order to even create something real, which is something I thought really came through as the relationship.
Well, they were. What's so interesting is that they were world-class architects, and they approached it in really different ways. John playing Schindler approaches it on an inspirational level, while the Neutra character approaches on a much more engineering and practical level. They ended up in the same place, being the best there is, and approach it truly from different directions. And I think they approach their lives from different directions as well. Schindler being radical, Neutra being conservative.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that, actually.
And I guess, like in many fields, you know, you could argue that the inspirational creators often burn out first.
But the burnout wasn't so much. See, that's what got me, is because the burnout was not in either one of you really burning out. There was something that happened, it seemed, and it did. And then you look at that, there's a, and I won't give anything away, but there's a statement at the end where actually you come together at a certain point and something beautiful emerges from a tiny little effort. And it's when you brought those two people together, you brought those two things together, the practicality, the functionalism, and the soaring visionary. And what that says about society itself, you know.
Mm-hmm. And partnerships that work.
And don't
until,
work.
Well, yeah. Until they become personal.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, there you go.
They're okay. Surely interesting characters.
Yeah.
They definitely are. And it's in a really incredible play, and I wish we had a lot more time to talk about it, but I'm ruled by a clock. As you can see, it's ticking down. It makes me really nervous. We got about 20 seconds, all right? So I want to let people know this is a really tremendous play, and it's The Princes of King's Road, which refers to a house that Schindler designed, and people can actually go see it today, right?
Yeah, it's a museum run by the Austrian government called the Mack House.
All right, we've been talking with playwright and director Tom Lazarus and the actress from the play The Princes of King's Road, John Nielsen and Ray Sifo. There you go. And folks, you know, I talk a lot about plays that I see, but this one was really one that really, really grabbed my heart and my head and caused me to have to go out with my friend and eat a lot of food afterwards. All right, I want to thank every one of my guests today. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at my new email. That's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with System of the Lost Cause Man from Ghetto Priest. Talk to you again next week.
World so full. I will never be part of their scene.